This podcast is brought to you by Lannan Foundation and is available at podcast.lannan.org.
Goodman, host of Democracy Now! It's wonderful to be back with you after just a few months on this evening that we celebrate cultural freedom. I also wanted to make a little announcement that we're very excited about. You know, Democracy Now! Has been broadcasting for years on KUNM, National Public Radio, and we are always honored to be there, as well as here in Santa Fe on KSFR Public Radio. But it is just, we have just been informed that starting on March 29th, New Mexico PBS, that's KNMD, channel 9.1, will be broadcasting Democracy Now! Television every Friday at 5 p.m. So I do hope you tune in. And I understand that Franz Joachim is in the audience, who is the director of programming now at New Mexico Public Television. So it's a wonderful development. In the spring of 2011, Tony Kish Kushner was supposed to be receiving an honorary degree from John Jay College of Criminal Justice in New York City. It shouldn't have been big news. He's a renowned playwright who won the Pulitzer Prize for drama for Angels in America, along with an Emmy Award, two Tonys. The decree did become big news, though, when it was abruptly shelved by the City University of New York Board of Trustees after a trustee accused Tony Kushner of being anti-Israel. A campaign grew almost immediately, first calling on previous recipients of honorary degrees from CUNY colleges to return them. Within days, what would have been a quickly forgotten bestowal of an honorary degree erupted into an international scandal. The controversy exposed the extreme polarity that increasingly defines the Israel-Palestine conflict. The chair of the board of CUNY, Benno Schmidt, the former president of Yale University, convened an emergency executive session of the board, and they voted unanimously to restore the honor to Tony Kushner. Yes, the extreme polarity of this issue and the willingness by some to suppress free speech and vigorous dialogue to further rigid political dogma. The trustee who attacked Tony Kushner began his tirade at the original board meeting with an attack on Mary Robinson, the former president of Ireland and the United Nations High Commissioner for Human Rights. I interviewed Tony Kushner at the time. He said, "I'm in no way an enemy of the State of Israel." He said, "I'm in fact a vocal and ardent supporter of the State of Israel. But I don't believe that criticism of state policy means that one seeks the destruction of a state." He said, "I've been very critical of the policies of my own government here in the United States as well." Well, when Tony Kushner got word that he would be getting the honorary degree, he said, "These people are not defending the State of Israel. They're not supporting it." He was talking about his critics. He said, "They're in fact causing a distortion of U.S. policy regarding Israel and a distortion of the internal politics of Israel itself, because they exert a tremendous influence in Israel and support right-wing politicians who I think have led the country into a dark and very dangerous place." During the McCarthy era, the U.S. was a dark and dangerous place as well. But now, amidst the uprisings in the Arab and Muslim world, and the recognition of Palestine as a non-member state of the United Nations, It is absolutely critical. There is no more urgent time for vigorous and informed debate. The future of peace in the Middle East depends on dissent. Those like Tony Kushner, with the courage to speak out, are the true angels in America. And as we talk about cultural freedom and how important it is to hear different views, it's fascinating now, in these coming weeks, as we move into Oscar season, that two of the five documentaries that have been Oscar nominated, that could receive an Academy Award, are about the Israel-Palestine conflict. One of them is called The Gatekeepers, and it is about the six surviving former heads of Shin Bet, the equivalent of a combination of the FBI and CIA of Israel. All of the surviving former heads of Shin Bet are interviewed in this film, The Gatekeeper. And one after the other, they warn about the cataclysm that the current leadership in Israel is heading towards. One of those former heads of Shin Bet, a Holocaust survivor himself, making comparisons, remarkably enough, between Israel and what he suffered when he was younger, talking about his fears about Nazi Germany. It is an astounding film. The other is called Five Broken Cameras, and it's about a Palestinian, not really filmmaker. He got a camera, Imad Bernat, to film his little boy growing up. At the same time, Israel began building the separation wall. And so he started to film the passive resistance in his community that continued to grow in Beilin. And as he filmed the clashes with the Israeli military, one by one, they broke his five cameras. These are two of the five films that are being considered for an Oscar. Yes, the debate is starting in this country, and that's what is critical, a discussion, whatever your point of view. In 2007, I had a chance to interview President Jimmy Carter, who wrote the book Palestine, Peace, Not Apartheid. This is former U.S. President Jimmy Carter, who said the word apartheid is exactly accurate. I interviewed him at the Carter Center in Atlanta, Georgia. He said, you know, this is an area that's occupied by two powers. They're now completely separated. Palestinians can't even ride on the same roads that the Israelis have created or built in Palestinian territory. The Israelis never see a Palestinian except the Israeli soldiers. The Palestinians never see an Israeli except at a distance except the Israeli soldiers. So within Palestinian territory, they're absolutely and totally separated, much worse than they were in South Africa, by the way. And the other thing is, says President Jimmy Carter, the other definition of apartheid is one side dominates the other, and the Israelis completely dominate the life of the Palestinian people. I asked President Carter, why don't Americans know what you have seen? And he said, Americans don't want to know, and many Israelis don't want to know what is going on inside Palestine. It's a terrible human rights persecution that far transcends what any outsider would imagine. Back to the issue of the Oscars. Many years ago, I had a chance to travel through the West Bank and Gaza with the, well, it wasn't at the time, but the person who would then get an Oscar for his documentary, with Michael Moore. And Michael wrote something interesting about our trip. He said, back in early 1988, as we traveled the back roads of the West Bank, going from one village to another, there was much that we saw that would make even the most committed among us give up hope, beset with the knowledge that true justice seemed like a faraway destination. After all, this was a struggle between a massive military machine that had nuclear weapons and children with slingshots. Who wins that fight? Well, there was a day a long, long time ago that an oppressed people had a young boy with a slingshot, and that boy used that slingshot, and for that, his people would be free. So we didn't leave Palestine in total despair. In fact, we were deeply inspired by the will and determination of the people we met. People who had nothing, people who were in it for the long haul and had no intention of giving up. It was a good lesson for us to learn. Tonight, I am introducing you for this cultural freedom lecture to Omar Barghouti. On the jacket of his book, Ilan Pappe, an Israeli academic who left Israel and is now a professor at the University of Exeter in England, and is co-author with Noam Chomsky of Gaza in Crisis, said, "For the first time, we have in front of us a succinct and poignant case made for the BDS strategy vis-a-vis Israel." He's talking about Omar Barghouti's book, BDS, Boycott, Divestment, Sanctions, The Global Struggle for Palestinian Rights. He says, this is Ilan Pappe, "There is no one better placed to make this case than Omar Barghouti, as this book shows clearly. This is a must-read for anyone interested in and committed to the Palestine cause, regardless of their particular stance on the BDS strategy." And that is what's critical here. Opening up this discussion, a discussion that is much more vibrant in Israel and the occupied territories, in Europe, but is beginning here. It's all about the debate. Omar Barghouti is a Palestinian researcher, commentator, human rights activist committed to upholding international law and universal human rights. He's a founding member of the Palestinian Campaign for the Academic and Cultural Boycott of Israel and the Palestinian Civil Society Boycott, Divestment, and Sanctions, the BDS campaign against Israel. He holds a bachelor's and master's degree in electrical engineering from Columbia University and a master's degree in philosophy from Tel Aviv University. First, Omar Barghouti will speak, and then we'll have a discussion. Omar Barghouti.
Thank you. Good evening. I'm very honored to be here. I'd like to thank the Lenin Foundation for inviting me and Amy for the wonderful introduction. I also want to recognize and acknowledge the ancestral land of several Indian tribes on which we stand today. And I want to tell them, we hear you, we hear your voices, we hear your cries for justice, we feel and share your sorrow as one dispossessed indigenous population to another, and we stand with you in your struggle for rights and dignity. A woman, alone, in near complete darkness, with a light shining from above on her, blocked from her view by an overbearing, dark, huge fabric. She struggles with the fabric, trying to free herself of it, and trying to make it not choke her. She goes on and on struggling in order to see the light. Eventually, she gets rid of the fabric, but she still cannot see the light. To her, it seems that overcoming this external fetter just exposed the internal ones, the chain in the head, so to speak, that has all along been the oppressor's most potent weapon. Decolonizing the mind then becomes the key to true freedom, one that is not reduced to the silly, intellectually degenerate contestation between two clowns in a circus held once every 4 years. You know what I'm talking about? Internalizing inferiority and accepting inequality and injustice as fate is the ultimate triumph of the oppressor. Therefore, decolonizing the mind becomes the most burning imperative for the oppressed in order to see the light. Now the oppressor colonizes the mind as well as the land, and the former is much more dangerous than the latter in very different ways. I'll just reflect on some of the experiences Palestinians have had with Israeli settler colonialism and occupation. In December 1987, in the first popular uprising, soon after it started, actually in February 1988, Israel shut down all 6 Palestinian universities and 13 colleges. Soon after, they shut down all 1,194 schools in the West Bank, and then all Palestinian kindergartens. Education became illegitimate, according to Israeli military rules. In fact, classes went underground, and any student held with a book in her hand was held accountable and arrested, and the book confiscated. Education became illegal in Palestine during the First Intifada. A Jerusalem Post article on 19 April 1989, in fact, reported that the Israeli police, without any sense of irony, they reported, the Israeli police had, quote, uncovered a network of illegal classes held by West Bank universities at private high schools in East Jerusalem. Scary. But this is not a new phenomenon. The attempt by Israel to colonize Palestinian minds goes as far back as 1948, during the Nakba, the initial campaign of ethnic cleansing of the majority of the indigenous Palestinians. Thanks to a Jewish Israeli graduate student who did his PhD on Israel's treatment of Palestinian books, we now know that Israel's Zionist militias and then the State of Israel systematically pillaged and destroyed tens of thousands of Palestinian books from private homes, from libraries, from schools, from everywhere. Destroyed them systematically. And this researcher said that Israel destroyed the Palestinian books in the framework of its plan to, quote, Judaize the country and cut off its Arab residents from their nation and culture. Sounds familiar in this country. This was a cultural massacre, he says, undertaken in a manner that was worse than European colonialism, which safeguarded the items it stole in libraries and museums. But we know that you cannot light a fire in a constrained area without the fire catching on to you. You get burnt as well. The oppressor is also somehow destroying something within when they try to dehumanize the other and destroy them. And this is reflected in testimonies by Israeli soldiers who fought in the first Israeli attack on Gaza 2008-2009. Some of the testimonies were extremely disturbing. I'll just quote a couple of them. A soldier narrated how a well-reported incident of intentionally shooting and killing an elderly Palestinian woman took place. He says, a company commander saw someone coming on some road, an old woman, he says. She was walking along pretty far away, but close enough so you could take her out. If she was suspicious, not suspicious, I don't know, he says. In the end, the commander sent people up to the roof to take her out, and so they did. So the journalist asks the soldier, why did they shoot her despite knowing that she's an elderly woman that posed absolutely no threat? And the soldier replies, that's what is so nice, supposedly, about Gaza. You see a person on a road, walking along a path. He doesn't have to be with a weapon. You don't have to identify him with anything, and you can just shoot him. This was further reflected in T-shirt designs. Israeli army platoons compete who can produce the most repulsive T-shirt designs. And some of these designs were truly scary. For example, one had a crosshairs on a pregnant woman's belly, a Palestinian pregnant woman's belly, with this bullseye superimposed on her belly, with the slogan in English, one shot, two kills. Another showed a soldier, Israeli soldier, raping a Palestinian girl, a girl, not a woman, and underneath it says, no virgins, no terror attacks. Israeli sociologist Orna Sasson-Levy reflected on this, saying that this phenomenon is a part of a radicalization process the entire country is undergoing, and the soldiers are at its forefront. There's a perception, she says, that the Palestinian is not a person, a human being entitled to basic rights, and therefore anything may be done to him. And I'll go over some titles and excerpts from the Israeli media on this dehumanization process, which I think is very important to put BDS in context. Haaretz, on July 5th, 2006, reported widespread illegal experiment conducted at Meir Hospital. 60 women were subjected to medical experimentation without their approval, predominantly Palestinian women. And a leading rabbi encouraged IDF soldiers to use Palestinian human shields, including children, as human shields. This was in Haaretz, October 2010. And then also in Haaretz, in 2010, the Israeli Supreme Court okays Jewish-only buildings in Jaffa. This is not a settlement in the West Bank. This is in Jaffa. The Supreme Court okayed Jewish-only buildings. And then a poll in 2011 in Yedioth Ahronot showed that 46% of Israeli teens want to revoke Arab citizens' rights. And in Petah Tikva, a city near Tel Aviv, the authorities, local authority, the municipality, announced that it was establishing a special team of youth counselors and psychologists whose job it will be to identify young Jewish women who are dating Arab men and rescue them. One of the few polls on the subject in 2007 found that more than half of Israeli Jews believed intermarriage with Arabs should be equated with, quote, national treason. And then Shlomi Eldar, who was a broadcaster in Channel 10, Israeli TV Channel 10, who reported from Gaza during the massacre 2008-2009, said, I came into possession of shocking material, the kind of material that sends you to a psychologist. I've never shown it. He self-censored, actually. Children who were shot, piles of bodies of civilians, and so on. And he says, a few days after the end of Operation Pillar of Defense, I gave a talk at a Herzliya high school. The children who said they came from good homes told me we have to kill all the Arabs, including the Israeli Arabs, because where do they get off thinking they will get control of the country? Their ideal, those students' ideal, he says, is to go into the army and kill as many Arabs as possible. And then a very recent poll in the end of 2012 that was reported in Haaretz by Gideon Levy, among others, showed that 58% of Jewish Israelis think that apartheid exists to a certain extent or in many issues in Israel today. But as I said, trying to dehumanize the other hurts you as well. You lose something from within. Very recently, this month, we found out that Israel admitted giving contraceptive injections to Ethiopian immigrant women. This led to a 50% decline in Ethiopian birth rate in Israel over the last decade. These women were coerced during the transit camps in Ethiopia. You take this or you don't go to Israel. And they were told those were inoculations. And later they found out that this reduced their fertility. This is happening now. This is not in the 30s. And to top it all off, Eli Yishai, an Israeli minister, interior minister, said about the whole controversy with the immigrants and the refugee seekers in Israel, mostly from Africa, black Africans. He was revolted by the numbers of those refugee seekers coming to Israel, and he said, most of those people arriving here are Muslims who think the country doesn't belong to us, the white man. The funny thing is, he's not white. He's a Sephardic Arab Jew. He's not exactly Ashkenazi. But he thinks. This is the reason why Israel's former Shin Bet chief, Yuval Diskin, had this to say recently as well, in April 2012. He said, over the past 10 to 15 years, Israel has become more and more racist. All of the studies point to this. This is racism towards Arabs and towards foreigners, and we're also become a more belligerent society. This is the head of Shabak speaking. The UN exposed a strategy of Judaization, that's what the UN called it, Raquel Rolnick, a UN Special Rapporteur, said, quote, from the Galilee and the Negev to East Jerusalem and the West Bank, the Israeli authorities promote a territorial development model that excludes, discriminates against, and displaces minorities, particularly affecting Palestinian communities, side by side with the accelerated development of predominantly Jewish settlements. And finally, on this track, there are some Israelis that are very alarmed that Israel is slipping into fascism. A bit of an exaggeration, I think, still, but certainly they see a trend happening. In response to the loyalty oath, which was proposed and accepted by Lieberman, and the Israeli government accepted it, Gabriel Solomon, an award-winning academic in Israel, went as far as comparing today's Israel to Germany in the 1930s. He said, the idea of Judenrein, a Jew-free zone, or Arab Rhine is not new. Some might say, how can you compare us to Nazis? And he says, I'm not talking about the death camps, but about the year 1935. There were no camps yet, but there were racist laws. And we are heading forward toward these kinds of laws. The government is clearly declaring our incapacity for democracy. End of quote. Another well-known Israeli figure, the Israeli writer Sefi Rachlevsky, differed on the time frame of the comparison. Rachlevsky said, the struggle today is not between left and right, but between Democrats and fascists. Israel is becoming fascist and racist. In a sense, you could say, we're more like not the madness that was in Germany in 1933, but in 1944-45. When they were in danger of losing the war, madness prevented them from stopping. End of quote. Going to the issue of rights and fighting against this escalating prevalence of racism, racial hatred, ethnic cleansing, siege of Gaza, and all kinds of policies by the oppressor, Palestinians insist on equal rights as all humans. Archbishop Desmond Tutu once said, I'm not interested in picking up crumbs of compassion thrown from the table of someone who considers himself my master. I want the full menu of rights. And exactly the same way, Palestinians, through the boycott, divestment, and sanctions movement, are seeking our full menu of rights. What do we mean by that? BDS, boycott, divestment, sanctions, is a call that was issued by a great majority of Palestinian civil society in 2005. It specifically called for three basic rights of the Palestinian people, three UN-respected rights: ending the occupation of 1967 with the colonies and the wall and so on, ending the system of racial discrimination in Israel, which conforms to the UN definition of apartheid, and third, the right of return for Palestinian refugees in accordance with UN Resolution 194. Why are Palestinians insisting on these three basic rights? Why can't we just stick to ending the occupation, which is talked about a lot? There's a debate in this country. I support Palestinian rights, therefore I support ending the occupation. Let's look at the statistics, and it will help us see things in context. According to 2012 statistics, there are 11.6 million Palestinians around the world today. 50% of them are in exile. 50% of the Palestinian people are not within historic Palestine, within the British Mandate Palestine, that's the State of Israel, the West Bank, and Gaza. 12% are Palestinian citizens of the State of Israel, and 38% are in the occupied territories, the West Bank, including East Jerusalem, and Gaza. That means ending the occupation would end the oppression, most of the oppression, against 38%, a minority of the Palestinians. Why did I say most of the oppression? Because among those 38%, 44% are refugees. Among the 12% in Israel, about 300,000 are refugees. Altogether, 69% of the Palestinian people are refugees. Without addressing the right of refugees to return, we're not addressing basic human rights of the Palestinian people. We are addressing ending the occupation alone today has become a demand by a big spectrum of Zionist Israel that wants to get rid of the Arabs because we are a demographic threat. This is normal language in Israel. We are a demographic threat. If used in any other country in the world, it's considered absolute racism. Not in Israel. This is mainstream language used from Peres to the far left of the Zionist spectrum, Amos Oz, and so on. Everyone agrees that Palestinians are a demographic threat. How best to get rid of them is what defines right, left, and center in Israel. But the entire spectrum is to the right by any international standard. So BDS called for boycotts, divestments, and sanctions against the state of Israel in order to end the occupation, apartheid, and to secure the right of return. It has various different facets: academic boycott, cultural boycott, economic, sports, and so on. The academic and the cultural boycott are the least understood and the most where there's misinformation about. Many people would say, doesn't that violate academic freedom and the right to exchange ideas and so on? Well, it doesn't, in fact, because the Palestinian academic and cultural boycott is nuanced. It's institutional in nature. It's not a blanket boycott against everyone and everything Israeli. It targets Israeli institutions due to their long history and presence of complicity in Israel's violations of human rights. So we target the institutions, not the individuals. We target institutional links, not individual human links between people. Unlike in South Africa, by the way, where the boycott was blanket against everyone South African. We've had a lot of successes since 2005 when BDS was launched until now, far beyond our most optimistic expectations, in fact. In 2011, the University of Johannesburg, very important symbolically, was the first to sever links with an Israeli university, Ben-Gurion University, over its complicity in human rights violations. In the cultural boycott, we've had many more successes than any other part of BDS, in fact. In the last 2 years alone, the number of artists who have canceled scheduled performances in Israel or who have refused altogether to play in Israel, to show their films in Israel, to participate in conferences, has mushroomed, has reached an extremely high level where Israel is extremely alarmed. In 2011, Israel passed... In 2011, Israel passed the anti-boycott law, which prevents Israeli citizens and residents from advocating for the boycott. And if you're Israeli and you write an article, say, I think the boycott is a good, moral, nonviolent form of resisting the occupation and apartheid, and the next day a settlement loses X million dollars of revenue due to some boycott in Europe succeeding, they can sue you, according to this law, and you'll have to pay a fine without having to prove, without the judges needing to see a correlation between your advocating for the boycott and the settlement's loss of revenue. It's the most draconian law. It's really Middle Ages type of laws. But as I usually say, it's the first draconian Israeli law that's not racist. It does not discriminate Arab or Jew. As long as you call for boycott, then you're held accountable. Trade unions have adopted BDS around the world, from South Africa, always the beginning in South Africa, COSATU, the Trade Union Federation, to Great Britain, the Trades Union Congress, representing some 7 million workers, to Brazil, the CUT, representing 22 million workers, and so on and so on and so forth. Not yet in the US, but hopefully soon. So we're seeing many trade unions around the world adopting the boycott. Many cultural figures, from Roger Waters of Pink Floyd to Alice Walker, I'll get to Alice later, to Judith Butler, Naomi Klein, Stéphane Hessel, the co-author of the Universal Declaration of Human Rights and a Holocaust survivor himself, many, many, many other authors, filmmakers, and artists have started advocating for BDS as an effective, moral, nonviolent strategy to achieve Palestinian rights. This has alarmed the establishment in Israel to a very large extent. But they were even further alarmed when South Africa's ruling party, the ANC, African National Congress, last December, a few weeks ago, adopted BDS officially, becoming the first ruling party in the world to adopt BDS. And I mentioned Alice Walker. In an interview with Amy Goodman, Alice Walker was reflecting on this comparison between the Palestinian occupied territories and South Africa, and between the Palestinian territories and the South in the U.S. She said, it's so much like the South of, 50 years ago, really, and actually more brutal, because in Palestine, so many more people are wounded, shot, killed, imprisoned. You know, there are thousands of Palestinians in prison virtually for no reason. So from her perspective, it's even more brutal than the South during the apartheid era in the U.S. We just did not call it apartheid then. Even British ambassador to Israel reflected on Israel's growing isolation, saying that Israel is losing friends in the mainstream. It's no longer on the left. In the very mainstream in Europe, Israel is losing friends. He says there's a growing concern in the UK over lack of progress towards peace with the Palestinians, and Israel was now being seen as Goliath, as Amy alluded to, against the Palestinians as David, Matthew Gould, the British ambassador to Israel, said. And there's a reason for Israel to be alarmed and for the British ambassador, who's so concerned about Israel, to be alarmed. A BBC poll, the Globe Scan, which is done every year, showed last year that Israel was competing with North Korea over the third worst perceived country in the world. The third worst perceived country in the world, on par with North Korea. And if you look at the countries, 74% in Spain viewed Israel mostly negatively, 65% of France, in Germany, 69%, Britain, 68%. Only the US, Nigeria, and Kenya thought that Israel, a majority viewed Israel positively, only those three countries. Every other country in the world, including Australia, Canada, every other country viewed Israel negatively, very negatively, in fact. Very recently, just a few days ago, the UN Human Rights Council fact-finding mission on the settlements did not just say the settlements were illegal, an impediment to peace, blah, 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 we all know the story. They called for sanctions. That's the first time they called for sanctions against the settlements, against the corporations that are profiting from the settlements, and indirectly against the state of Israel because of the settlements. This is new discourse at the UN. We haven't heard this kind of language in decades. We have reason to think that there are two distinct factors leading to this upping of the ante at the UN, so to speak. The BDS movement, the growth of the BDS movement, the winning of the hearts and minds across the world, and increasingly in the US as well. And the second factor, the far-right shift in Israel. I always say, give credit where credit belongs. Without Netanyahu and Lieberman, we could not have done it. But now even President Obama is reflecting on Israel's isolation and revealing that. According to Jeffrey Goldberg, who's very close to the White House, we now know that Obama thinks that Israel is heading towards near total isolation and towards an apartheid status. And he says, well, he's paraphrased, saying that if Israel, a small state in an inhospitable region, we're always inhospitable, a jungle, becomes more of a pariah, one that alienates even the affections of the U.S., its last steadfast friend, it won't survive. So, again, Obama is paraphrased, saying, Iran poses a short-term threat to Israel's survival. Israel's own behavior poses a long-term threat. So that's not coming from some lefty in Europe. That's the President of the United States. Now, I'll talk about some BDS campaigns and why this atmosphere that Israel's impunity is reaching its end and accountability before international law is on the rise against Israel. They feel it and we feel it. Israel is extremely alarmed about the growth of BDS to the extent, just one example, Israeli Apartheid Week, which is a campus-based BDS event that goes on around the world, many, many campuses, including University of New Mexico and Albuquerque, and many, many across the world, alarmed the Israeli Foreign Ministry so much that last year, Lieberman sent 100 paid emissaries to counter Israeli Apartheid Week around the world. 100. They did not do that against Iran, by the way. They just used their embassies and their propaganda and the brand Israel type of propagandists and lobbies and so on. But that wasn't enough for Israeli Apartheid Week. They had to send the troops, 100 emissaries, to fight that. Also, the economic aspect of the boycott is really starting to hurt. Companies that have been colluding with Israel's violations of human rights with total impunity are now feeling the pinch. They're losing revenue because of it. So there's accountability on the rise. I'll just give a few examples. Veolia, which is spreading in this country with the privatization of water, sewage, and so on, Veolia is buying a lot of those previously public-owned companies. Veolia is involved in the Jerusalem Light Rail, which is a project serving the illegal colonies in and around occupied Jerusalem. So it's an illegal project. We've targeted Veolia and its partner, Alstom, two French companies, since November 2008. Since then, until now, less than five years, Veolia has lost more than $16 billion worth of contracts. $16 billion. And this is mainly done by BDS activists, sometimes starting with three, four activists in a little basement and then growing to affect thousands of people. I'll just give an example of the North London contract worth $7.4 billion, I believe. Veolia just very recently withdrew from that bidding because there was enormous public pressure by citizens of North London who pressured the municipality, kick Veolia out of the bidding process or we won't elect you. And politicians are politicians. They want to get reelected. So ultimately, the pressure was very high on Veolia until it withdrew, losing the $7.4 billion contract. And this has repeated itself in Sweden, in Wales, in Ireland, across Europe. We're seeing more and more successes against Veolia. Even in the US, as I said, BDS is really growing in the United States. Caterpillar. There's been a campaign against Caterpillar by the U.S. campaign for to end the Israeli occupation, and most recently by Jewish Voice for Peace, a very important partner in the United States. JVP led a campaign to pressure TIAA CREF, the largest pension fund in the U.S., to divest from companies profiting from Israel's occupation. And now they have a big coalition with Quaker groups, with various human rights groups, church groups, and so on, interfaith groups, all supporting this campaign, and it's spreading across campuses nationwide. This is a very important campaign that had its first success last year when the Morgan Stanley Index, a very important investment index, removed Caterpillar from its ethically responsible list. That was a very important victory for us. And that eventually led to Caterpillar being, to TIA CREF divesting from Caterpillar from its socially responsible index as well. That was a very important progress for us. We've had some progress with the Methodist Church and the Presbyterian Church. Also JVP, Jewish Voice for Peace, as well as the U.S. campaign played a key role in that. They adopted a boycott against settlement products and they adopted sanctions against Israel, as in stop U.S. military aid to Israel until it respects human rights. So we have two large churches in the U.S. adopting BDS-type measures against Israel. It's very important to remember, and there are many, many other examples. Code Pink, the anti-war movement, predominantly feminist movement, they targeted one specific product, Ahava, which is the cosmetics made of Dead Sea products. Most of its production is done in an illegal colony in the occupied West Bank. So they targeted this one particular brand, one particular company, and it spread across the world. Of course, they were very creative, you know, demonstrating in pink bikinis in big malls. That attracts the Washington Post and CNNs and everyone else. And it spread. In the Netherlands, it was too cold, so they couldn't wear bikinis. They wore bathrobes. But it still attracted the entire Dutch media, and in Australia and everywhere. So BDS does not come in one flavor or one size that fits all. It depends a lot on the context sensitivity principle. So it depends on the creativity and innovation of local activists. I'll give an example in the Netherlands. One Dutch woman who was a veteran of the anti-apartheid movement, one of the leaders of the anti-apartheid movement in the Netherlands, started a campaign to convince a bank in the Netherlands to stop its operations in Israel that was supporting the settlements. She went to the bank and spoke to the top manager of the bank, presenting all the facts, all the documents, human rights, international law, blah, blah, blah. But he's a banker. You know, ethics is Chinese. Anyway, or Arabic, whatever the context may be. But then he said, okay, I'll consider the documents. She said, great, when can I see you again to see what you've decided after considering what I've presented to you? He said 3 months, whatever. So she came after 3 months with a bunch of lawyers, community leaders, feminist leaders, LGBT, and the whole alliance of people that wanted to pressure the bank. So they went to the bank manager and they said, you know, the banks are not having their best times, really. There's a lot of competition and we can just pull our money and go to the next bank. You're all the same to us. We want to see action. We want to see an end of your complicity. After 6 months, they divested. They sold off their operation in Israel, and this bank stopped investing in the settlement industry. So that was a success by one particular woman. But here in the U.S. as well, UC Irvine, just a few weeks ago, the student council, whatever they call it, the student government, unanimously passed a resolution calling for divestment from companies invested in the Israeli occupation. Unanimously. Earlham College kicked Sabra Hummus out of their cafeteria. There's so many successes. Mecha, the largest Latino-Latina youth movement in the United States, adopted BDS at their national conference last year, and so on and so forth. It's really growing. I tour the U.S. quite often, and I speak on campuses quite often, from Princeton's and Yale's and Columbia's to the smallest community colleges. And I'm noticing a trend that I was telling Amy as we were driving to here that's scaring the Israeli establishment and the Israel lobby establishment in this country. The conversion, so to speak, of young Jewish activists away from Zionism towards the human rights perspective. We're seeing that increasingly. Across the United States, we're seeing young Jewish activists joining the BDS movement, joining divestment campaigns, and it's scaring the hell out of those establishment, the ADLs and APACs and so on of the world, who want to speak on behalf of all Jews, who want to monopolize the Jewish voice. So it's not just Israel, it's also Israel's organs in this country who say it's them versus the Jews. It's the Arabs, the Palestinians, the Muslims, the nutty leftists against the Jews, as if they speak for all the Jews. And this leads them to accuse BDS of anti-Semitism. We're hearing that a lot. If anyone is following the controversy over the Brooklyn College event, Judith Butler and I are speaking about BDS at Brooklyn College next Thursday. And there's a nationwide campaign of vilification, intimidation, and bullying, and horrific, to try to scuttle this event. And the number one accusation is anti-Semitism and Jew hatred. Forget that Judith Butler is not just Jewish, and her philosophy is very much immersed in the social justice notions of Judaism. Put that aside. Self-hating Jew, obviously. let's try to consider this anti-Semitism accusation. I've said this before and I'll repeat it. Those who say boycotting Israel is anti-Semitic are making an anti-Semitic statement. Let me explain why. Because they're saying that all Jews are one monolithic sum and Israel speaks on their behalf and represents them. So if you attack Israel, you attack the Jews. All the Jews are the same. Only Nazis and Zionists think all the Jews are the same. Anyone who thinks all Jews are anything is an anti-Semite, because all Jews are nothing, one monolithic nothing. There's nothing that combines all Jews. They're part of the human species, which means they have diversity. They can't be all the same. Anyone who claims that is an anti-Semite. So the Zionist leaders in this country are making anti-Semitic statements when they say attacking Israeli policy is attacking the Jews. There's also a growth of BDS, not just on campuses, not just among faith groups, also among academics, cultural workers, who are increasingly voicing concerns about Israeli policies. Jewish Voice for Peace led an effort whereby tens of leading Hollywood, Broadway artists in the U.S., many of them Jewish, signed a statement supporting an Israeli partial selective boycott against the colonies, against Ariel, and against the settlements. Okay, it's a partial boycott, but associating the B word and Israel in one sentence in any context in this country was absolutely taboo not too long ago. Now, Hollywood and Broadway figures are ready to consider a boycott of anything Israeli. That's a huge step forward, and it's popularizing the concept that only through pressure, as in South Africa, as in the civil rights movement and the bus company, Montgomery Bus Company boycott, you need pressure to bring those companies to accountability and to make states stop oppressing the people that they're oppressing. So I think that the concept of pressure to get to human rights has been vindicated to a large extent. In the end, I wrote a piece in March 2011, a wish, actually, that I wish to share with you. That was at the height of the Arab Spring, and many people then had a lot of hope. I still have a lot of hope, despite all the challenges of the Arab Spring. No revolution succeeds in a couple of years. They've been living in tyranny without any democracy for decades. It will take a lot of struggle, infighting, to get there. So it's not an easy process, and we should not give up hope yet. But I wrote this letter, this wish, to our American, European, Western brothers and sisters, not to the Arabs. It's called I Wish You Egypt. It's a short piece, and I'll end with it. An open letter to people of conscience in the West. I wish you Egypt. I wish you empowerment to resist, to fight for social and economic justice, to win your real freedom and equal rights. I wish you the will and skill to break out of your carefully concealed prison walls. See, in our part of the world, prison walls and are thick, inviolable doors and are too overt, obvious, overbearing, choking. This is why we remain restive, rebellious, agitated, and always in preparation for our day of freedom, of light, when we gather a critical mass of people power enough to cross all the hitherto categorical red lines. We can then smash the thick, cold, ugly, rusty chains that have incarcerated our minds and bodies for all our lives, like the overpowering stench of a rotting corpse in our claustrophobic prison cell. Your prison cells, however, are quite different. Their walls are well hidden, invisible, lest they evoke your will to resist. There's no door to your prison cell. You may roam about freely, never recognizing the much larger prison you're still confined to. I wish you Egypt, so you can decolonize your minds. For only then can you envision real liberty, real justice, real equality, and real dignity. I wish you Egypt, so you can tear apart the sheet with a multiple choice question, what do you want? For all the answers you are given are dead wrong. Your only choice there seems to be between evil and a lesser one. I wish you Egypt so you can, like the Tunisians, the Egyptians, and indeed the Palestinians, shout, no, we do not want to select the least wrong answer. We want another choice altogether that is not on your damned list. Given the choice between slavery and death, we unequivocally opt for freedom and dignified life. No slavery and no death. I wish you Egypt so you can collectively, democratically and responsibly rebuild your societies, to reset the rules so as to serve the people, not savage capital and its banking arm, to end racism and all sorts of discrimination, to look after and be in harmony with the environment, to cut wars and war crimes, not jobs, benefits, and public services, to invest in education and healthcare, not in fossil fuel and weapons research. This is scary in New Mexico, I know, but I have to say it. To overthrow the repressive, tyrannical rule of multinationals and to get the hell out of Afghanistan, Iraq, and everywhere else where under the guise of spreading democracy, your government's self-righteous crusades have spread mass murder, social and cultural disintegration, abject poverty, and utter hopelessness. I wish you Egypt so you can fulfill your country's legal and moral obligations to help rebuild the ravished, de-developed economies and societies of your former or current colonies so that their young men can find their own homelands viable, livable, and lovable again instead of risking death or worse on the high seas to reach your mirage-washed shores, giving up loved ones and a place they once called home. You see, they are here because you were there and we all know what you did there. I wish you Egypt so you can adopt BDS to end the immoral hypocrisy that maintains your state's complicity in Israel's settler colonialism, apartheid, and occupation, to rekindle the spirit of the South African anti-apartheid struggle for freedom. Our oppression and yours are deeply interrelated and intertwined. It is never a zero-sum game. Our joint struggle for universal rights and freedoms is not merely a self-gratifying slogan that we raise. Rather, it's a fight for true emancipation and self-determination, an idea whose time has vociferously arrived. After Egypt, it is our time. It is time for Palestinian freedom, justice, and equality. It is time for all the people of this world, particularly the most exploited and downtrodden, to reassert our common humanity and reclaim control over our common destiny. I wish you Egypt. Thank you.
That concludes the reading for this event. Up next is the conversation.
Omar, can you talk a little about where you come from? You were born in Qatar and how you came to be one of the leaders of the BDS movement.
I was born to two refugee parents. My mother's side, her mother, came from Safad, which is now in the state of Israel, the refugees of the 1948 ethnic cleansing. My father's side is a refugee from the 1967 war. So to us, Palestinian rights and politics was always part of our growing up. It wasn't a foreign concept to us. When I came to the U.S. to study...
Lived in Egypt after...
I lived in Egypt, yes. I finished high school in Egypt. And then I came to New York, to Columbia University, where I studied engineering. And that helped a lot widen my horizon, so to speak, and get exposed to very different ideas. From Marxism, which I discovered then, actually. In Egypt, I had no experience with Marxism, to Adam Smith and capitalist theoreticians and so on. So I think my political awareness grew at that period much more than before.
Mm-hmm. And so how did you end up back in the West Bank?
I got married to a Palestinian who is a citizen of the State of Israel in New York, and we had our first child. Then we went back. My child immediately got entitled to Israeli citizenship because it follows the mother, but not so easy for me. So I went back on a visit permit, and then we applied for family unification. I'm a refugee, so I hold a Jordanian citizenship. But because I'm not Jewish, I'm not entitled to anything automatically. It's a very long battle for a Palestinian citizen of Israel to bring her spouse to live with her. And at the time, I was interrogated by the Shabak, by the Shin Bet, and I was openly told during the interrogation process, we thought we got rid of one Arab when your wife left to study for her master's at NYU, and she comes back with two more. So the demographic threat was very much clear from the very start. And then we went through a long process of challenging the authorities to get permanent residence. Eventually, I won the case after a year, and I got my permanent residence in Israel. But all along, I was active. When I was in New York, I was active with the General Union of Palestinian Students. I was active in various activities. And during the interrogation, actually, they opened my big, thick file, and they went on and on and on. One example said, during the 1982 war on Lebanon, you participated in a demonstration at the Israeli mission to the United Nations. And I said, you're insulting me. Participated? I was one of the organizers, for God's sake. But what's illegal about that? I mean, kill me, sue me, because I participated in a nonviolent demonstration against the Israeli massacres in Lebanon. So it was a very challenging process. And at that time, 93, we were able to win that case. Now we wouldn't be able to.
Because
the entire, as I mentioned, the entire political spectrum in Israel has shifted in the last couple of decades to the extreme right. Some people totally misread the recent election, saying, oh, the right is still dominant, but not as dominant. Some moderates won the middle ground. That's not true, in fact. Those moderates have completely adopted the right-wing agenda vis-a-vis Palestinian rights. There are hardly any differences between Tzipi Livni, Olmert, Barak, Netanyahu, Lieberman. Very few differences when it comes to the key issues of Palestinian rights, refugee rights, equality in Israel, and full end to the occupation. With the exception of Meretz, to the far left of the Zionist spectrum, there's almost consensus among the Zionist parties in Israel.
How does debate in the United States around Israel-Palestine compare to what happens in Israel?
Where do I start? Well, I just was reading the papers yesterday and today about the congressional hearing of Hegel. And although I lived in the U.S. for 11 years and I've read the New York Times religiously for 25 years, I was still shocked. It felt like an Israel first McCarthyist inquisition, not a congressional hearing for a Secretary of Defense of this country. So I feel that the debate here is still in a very primitive stage because the lobby crushes any dissent. When famous Jewish intellectuals are called haters of Jews and self-haters and so on, when academics lose their jobs in universities for daring to publish something remotely critical of Israel, when journalists lose their jobs and so on, it's an extremely intimidating atmosphere. So I think the debate is still at a very primitive stage, in the mainstream at least, but it's growing tremendously on campuses. And they cannot stop that. With the growth of the social media, with the growth of the blogs and the more independent media, with Democracy Now!, with all the brave voices that are coming up, I think the mainstream media is losing its hold on public opinion, and awareness is rising at a much faster pace. Mm. So I remain very hopeful. In the last couple of years, I've seen a change. One example is a Jody Rudoran article in the New York Times 2 days ago. Jody wrote about Bitar Yerushalayim, an Israeli far-right soccer team, and she wrote about how the fans raised a slogan, "Keep Bitar pure Jewish," because the owner planned to get two Muslim soccer players sacrilege. And she reported in the New York Times, not in some blog, in the New York Times, that many saw this as reminiscent of Nazi purification of athletic teams in the 30s. In the New York Times, I wrote to Jody, I never expected to read those words in the New York Times. So clearly there's a shift that's happening, slow, but it's happening.
Mm-hmm. How did BDS get started?
BDS is rooted in a long tradition of Palestinian nonviolent popular resistance, because many people think that it's entirely based on the South African anti-apartheid boycott movement. It's very much inspired by the South African as well as the U.S. civil rights movement, but it's not rooted in those. It's rooted in the Palestinian heritage of popular resistance. As far back as the 1920s, we've had boycotts and strikes and demonstrations and women's movements taking action against British products, Zionist products at the time, and so on. So it's very much rooted in the First Intifada. There were famous boycotts of Israeli products and of boycotting the tax in Beit Sahur, for example, near Bethlehem. So it's very much a Palestinian form of resistance. But in 2005, after the Israeli reoccupation, reinvasion of the West Bank 2002 and the massacre in the Jenin refugee camp, many intellectuals and academics and activists reached the conclusion that the international community under U.S. hegemony is unable, unwilling, or both, to hold Israel to account. Israel has a free rein to do whatever it wishes to the Palestinian people with the total protection of the U.S. Congress and therefore Europe, the U.S. government, and so on. This led us to believe that we've got to go the path of the South African movement and call for international solidarity. The main concept in BDS in 2005 was that ending complicity in Israel's violations of international law and human rights is not heroic. It's a basic moral obligation. We're asking institutions to end their support for an illegal system, not to come to the garrisons, as it were, and fight with us against the occupation. Just end your support to the occupation, we'll take care of the rest.
How does boycott, divestment, sanction movement, Where does a one-state or a two-state solution fit into this?
It doesn't, because the BDS movement is the largest coalition in Palestinian society. It includes all the political parties, the NGO networks, the refugee networks, women's groups, trade unions. Everyone is in the BDS National Committee, which leads the BDS movement. So from the start, we built it as a rights-based movement, anti-racist movement, completely anchored in international law and human rights. We take absolutely no position on the one state versus two states debate, very intentionally so, because this is not an issue that Palestinians agree on. There's a lot of debate within the BDS movement. So we said, this is about Palestinian rights under international law. Regardless of what the political outcome might be, those three rights, ending occupation, ending apartheid, and the right of return, should be respected, because these are basic fundamental rights for the entire Palestinian people. But each one of us, as activists, have his or her opinion. Personally, for 30 years, I've defended a secular democratic state in historic Palestine, equal rights for all, independently of identity, religious, ethnic, or any other identity. And I continue to defend that, but not within the movement. The point is, each one is involved in various other activities. They can do that, but outside the BDS movement.
What is your feeling about Palestine being recognized as a non-member observer state at the United Nations?
It's a step in the right direction, but it can go in a very negative way. Excuse me. If this state, which does not exist in reality, replaces the PLO as the voice of the Palestinians. Why is this a danger? Because the great majority of the Palestinian people are not part of this state. They're not in the West Bank and Gaza. So if the state speaks for the Palestinians, it will speak for its own Palestinian citizens, not those in exile, not the Palestinian citizens of Israel. Excuse me.
One of the more controversial aspects of BDS is the boycott of academic institutions in Israel. Explain.
Yeah, the first attack was that we are blacklisting academics, which is absolutely false. I mean, there's no testing, blacklisting, or any other term being used against academics. It's completely targeting institutions. But still, we were attacked by liberal Zionist groups, mainly, in the U.S., in Israel, and elsewhere, that you're shooting yourself in the foot. Attacking academic institutions that are at the forefront of the struggle against the occupation must be self-defeating. What are you doing? Why start with the academy? And actually, this is based on a lot of myths propagated by those soft Zionists, that Israeli academics somehow stand at the forefront of the battle for Palestinian rights. It's absolutely false. There's no evidence of this on record. I'll just give a couple of examples. Other than the fact that all Israeli academic institutions are deeply, deeply complicit in planning, implementing, justifying, and whitewashing Israel's violations of international law, all polls among Israeli academics do not show any difference from the general public. They're just as right-wing, just as opposed to Palestinian rights. In 2008, four Jewish Israeli academics started a petition asking the authorities in the territories, they did not even call them occupied territories, lest they offend, calling on the Israeli authorities in the territories to allow Palestinian academics and students access to their schools. Basic academic freedom. They sent it to all 9,000 Israeli academics, hoping that every decent academic should sign that. It's not calling for ending the occupation or anything, God forbid. Just allow them access. 407 signed out of 9,000 academics. We don't have any evidence of the Israeli academics standing in their majority for anything, even ending the occupation.
What does it mean, boycott of academic institutions? What does that mean?
It means severing institutional links. So, for example, academics usually do not represent their universities. They are affiliated with their universities. If you're an academic going to present a paper at a conference in Norway, let's say, you're not representing your institution. You're representing yourself. The boycott does not prevent that because we do not target individuals. Once there's representation, So let's say this university in Norway has an exchange program with Hebrew University. That's an institutional link. We target that link to break that link. Now, there's a nuance to it. Thanks to a brave Israeli writer who revealed in Haaretz in 2008, there's a contract that Israeli academics, poets, writers, musicians, dancers have to sign to get Israeli foreign ministry money, an actual contract. And there are two clauses in this contract that say, I shall not undermine the policies of the State of Israel. I shall do my best to serve the policies of the State of Israel. After learning about this contract, we immediately, the boycott campaign, said anyone who signs this contract is forfeiting any claim to academic or cultural freedom. They're accepting to be ambassadors of the State of Israel, not poets, not writers, not academics. If they accept this money on this condition to serve the policies of an apartheid colonial state, they should not enjoy academic freedom.
Are you saying Palestinian students shouldn't attend these universities?
No, there's no clause in the academic boycott against Palestinian students studying at universities or going to hospitals in Israel or working in Israel. The reason is because we're a captive economy, we're a captive society, and in many, many cases, Palestinians do not have an option. Because Israel systematically impeded the growth of Palestinian institutions, closed universities for years and so on, we do not have PhD programs, for example, very few. So many PhD students have to either go abroad or study at Israeli universities. Our hospitals are very basic. Many operations are not done at Palestinian hospitals. So you have got to get hospitalization in Israeli hospitals and so on. So there's nothing in the boycott that prevents that.
What about, for example, these Oscar-nominated films, The Gatekeepers, made by an Israeli filmmaker, and Five Broken Cameras is based on the footage of a Palestinian filmmaker, resident of Berlin, but it is made by an Israeli filmmaker?
The second is different than the first. In the boycott guidelines, we make a clear distinction between an Israeli cultural worker getting money that he or she is entitled to as a taxpayer. There's nothing in the boycott that prevents that. If I'm an Israeli filmmaker and I get some cultural fund from government foundations, I'm entitled to that as a taxpayer. I should not be held accountable because I got this money, so long as there are no political conditions. If I sign a contract saying I will serve the policies of the State of Israel, then I'm making my film target of the boycott campaign. The second film, Five Broken Cameras, is a more controversial issue. I don't want to get into details because this is very much debated among us, but there's almost agreement that the Palestinian filmmaker was, how should I put it, manipulated, so to speak. The mainstream media in the US presented Five Broken Cameras as an Israeli film because it received partial funding from Israel, but it also received partial funding from Europe. The main inspiration, the main stories, the main narrative is a Palestinian narrative. For this to be presented at the Oscars as an Israeli film is an insult, really an insult. But this is an internal discussion that we're having with the Palestinian filmmaker, with the Bilayin Popular Resistance Committee, which supports our campaign in full.
Mm-hmm. How does the resistance in the United States compare to the rest of the world in places like Europe?
It's far less civilized. Let's start with that. Very uncivilized. Thuggish to a very large extent. I mean, the intimidation factor, the bullying factor in the U.S. is just bounds beyond anything we're seeing anywhere in the world, including in Israel. Literally, in some respect. Again, going back to this Brooklyn College event, one politician said that this can be a start of a second Holocaust. Judith Butler and a Palestinian human rights activist speaking about BDS at Brooklyn College is a beginning of a second Holocaust? I mean, just some proportion? So this is the atmosphere of intimidation, but I think this reflects weakness, not strength, because Israel's lobby is losing influence in the mainstream. It still has Congress in its pocket, granted, And that's not something easy to deal with. It's Congress. It has all the power. But at the grassroots level, on campuses, among faith communities, and so on, African-American communities, Latino communities, they're losing power. And that's making them much more nervous. And among Jewish communities as well, I think.
How significant is other kinds of resistance, like the freedom flotillas, the challenging of the blockade of Gaza, for example, or the siege of Gaza, where they each end up getting taken? The boats are sent from places around the world with international people who are critics of Israel, and they get taken to Ashdod, and they get prevented, of course, from going to Gaza.
I think it's very important to raise awareness about the siege of Gaza. And I think resistance to Israel's occupation and apartheid has to be in very diverse and creative ways. It's not just one way. But ultimately, if it does not translate to building a movement in one's country to help end that country's complicity, then it will go to waste. So showing solidarity in a creative way, going to the sea, is extremely courageous, extremely creative. But ultimately, it takes going back home and starting a campaign that's more sustainable and building a movement. So Alice Walker is an excellent example of that. She did not just go on the flotilla. When she came back to the U.S., she started speaking and educating and advocating. And she really set an excellent example. Angela Davis, Naomi Klein, Judith Butler, and among others, are doing exactly the same. It's not just one gesture of solidarity, and that's the end of it. They're helping to build a movement.
I wanted to get your comment on critics of Israel who disagree with BDS. We had you on Democracy Now! Debating, for example, Arthur Waskow of the Shalom Center. We've had Norman Finkelstein on, who is a leading critic of Israel, who said, the consensus is clear. It's a two-state settlement on the June 67 border and a just resolution of the refugee question based on the right of return and compensation. He said, do my personal views go beyond that limit? Yes, they do. But politics is not about personal opinions. It's about trying to reach a public and getting them to act on their own sense of right and wrong. Your response to that?
I'd rather not comment on Norman Finkelstein, out of respect for his history, when once he was supportive of Palestinian rights, full Palestinian rights. So I'd rather not comment on him. With other critics of the BDS movement, they remind me of what Martin Luther King said in the Birmingham jail letter, when he said, the moderate white has become the real hindrance towards black freedom by telling us what to want, what to demand, when to demand it, and by totally patronizing our struggle, never giving us a voice, never listening to us. It is so colonial, really colonial, for somebody sitting in this country, especially a white person sitting in this country, telling us, wait a minute, the entire Palestinian civil society is asking for ending occupation, ending apartheid, and the right of return, because these are our basic rights under international law. We're not asking for the moon. But no, you should not ask for that. You should go with the consensus in Brooklyn. Who said the consensus is in Brooklyn is what matters in the world?
BDS got a lot of attention in the United States with this major vote in the Brooklyn Food Co-op, which is not a small co-op. Thousands and thousands
Park Slope,
of people.
Yes.
Right, the Park Slope Food Co-op. It lost, but not by much. Talk about the significance of that organizing and how it happened.
I think this is one factor that raised the alarm bells with the establishment Israel lobby in this country, that Park Slope is in a very Jewish community in Brooklyn. So for the vote on BDS to be defeated by a 40-60 margin, I think it was a huge victory for the BDS movement, because this is in the heart of Brooklyn. This is not some liberal elsewhere that has many, many critics of Israel. It just showed that no one monopolizes the Jewish voice. It was an extremely important moment when alternative Jewish groups like JVP and other groups could claim victory, that we have a significant minority supporting us, and that the establishment is losing a lot of support in the grassroots. And many people say, well, if we compare with South Africa, it was so different then. Everyone was on board, you know, the churches, the Jewish groups and the unions and the teachers and everyone. People have short memory or selective amnesia. I was active in the anti-apartheid movement at Columbia University. I know how long it took to pressure our university to divest from South Africa. It wasn't easy. It took years and years of tireless work to get there, and many, many tactics, and blocking Columbia College with chains and whatnot. It took a lot of struggle. The South Africans started calling for the boycott in the 1950s. It became mainstream in the 1980s. 30 years. People forget that. So people are taking a snapshot of the 80s and saying, it was so popular. Well, give us a few more years.
You live in Ramallah. Can you talk about life in the West Bank versus life in Gaza and what it means and how you communicate?
Life under occupation in general is extremely difficult, obviously. Freedom of movement is gone. You cannot plan anything because you can get stopped at a checkpoint and it can ruin anything.
Explain what a day is like there.
For example, if you want to drive from Ramallah to Nablus, if you have business, if you want to go even from Ramallah, you want to go to your farmland in some village around Ramallah, you have no guarantee that you can reach your farmland. If you're a pregnant woman who wants to go to hospital in Jerusalem or Ramallah because around your village there's no hospital, you can get stuck at a checkpoint and you can be forced by the soldiers to give delivery. Tens of Palestinian women were forced to give delivery at checkpoints. Many of those babies died, obviously, because they're not sanitary conditions. Farmers lost their harvests year after year for being prevented by soldiers. In some extreme cases, like in Qalqilia, it's a city in the north of the West Bank, totally, completely surrounded by wall, by Israel's wall and fences. If you want to go to your farmland, you have to get a permit from the military occupation. And this permit is never issued when it's time for harvesting. So you till the land and you work and you work, and when it's time to collect your olives, you can't. And you lose it. Year after year. Another extremely important method of expelling Palestinians from fertile lands and where the water aquifers are is something revealed by Amnesty International. In 2009, Amnesty revealed how Israel is using denial of access to water resources as a, quote, means of expulsion. So, for instance, Palestinian farmers for centuries, for generations, have been harvesting rainwater in the rain season to use it for the dry season in the summer. It became illegal with the occupation to collect rainwater because rainwater falling on your farmland does not belong to you. You're stealing the property of the State of Israel. They own the rain that falls on your land. And this is something people don't realize. If you dig a well, a cistern, any mechanism to collect rainwater, you're violating a dozen military laws, and they send their bulldozers, usually Caterpillar, and destroy your wells. You can't collect rainwater. It's illegal in Area C, which is 60% of the West Bank. But all this pales in comparison with Gaza, because you asked about the differences. Yes, we have walls and denial of freedom of movement, and women die at checkpoints giving birth and so on, but it's still much better than Gaza. Gaza is really a prison camp, as even British Prime Minister recognized. It's one huge ghetto, surrounded completely by walls.
Explain what Prime Minister Cameron said.
He said it's a prison camp. Those are his words. For a conservative British Prime Minister to say Gaza is a prison camp takes some courage. But he said it after visiting. And even Congress people who visited were shocked by the reality. Just some examples of this reality. 95% of the water supply in Gaza is contaminated and unfit for human consumption. We're seeing new diseases that developed with the siege of Gaza that Gazans had never heard of before. One disease reported by Amnesty International is methemoglobinemia, which has a symptom of blueness of the hands and arms of babies, newborn babies. sometimes they suffocate and they cannot catch their breath, and sometimes they die. It's due to nitrate contamination in the water supply. And Israel prevents the equipment needed to purify the water from entering Gaza. At one point, Israel was counting calories for years, counting the actual calories allowed into Gaza to bring people to the edge of starvation, but not there yet, because they don't. It doesn't look good on CNN if people start dying en masse. And this is according to a policy that Sharon's advisor, Dov Weisglass, said will put the Palestinians on a diet. And they did. They counted the actual calories. And they get shocked when some Israeli compares Israel to 1930s Germany.
Just today's headline that we read on Democracy Now!, a new UN report has strongly condemned Israeli settlements in the West Bank, saying they violate the Geneva Convention and must be dismantled immediately, or Israel could potentially face charges at the International Criminal Court. The UN Human Rights Council says Israeli settlements are leading to a creeping annexation that prevents the establishment of a contiguous and viable Palestinian state and undermines the right of the Palestinian people to self-determination. Israel, however, boycotted the Council's review of its human rights record this week, becoming the first country ever to do so.
The most interesting part of this report is that for the first time, it called for sanctions against the settlements. It didn't just say, dismantle the settlements and pull out all the settlers. All of this is illegal and is potentially a war crime, according to the Fourth Geneva Convention, that it said. But it said, states and entities around the world should take action, should take punitive measures against the settlements, against corporations profiting from the settlements, and against the state of Israel that's building the settlements. And that's the first we've heard of any insinuation of sanctions by a UN body in a very, very, very long time. So it's a very important report that's taken very seriously in many circles, including in Israel.
How close do you think Palestinians are coming to having a state, if your first two-state solution, or equality for one-state solution? How would you compare it to where South Africa was along that spectrum? And ultimately, what gives you hope?
That's a tough question. I don't know, really. I don't know the answer to that, because I don't think anyone can predict what Israel might do next. Yes, we can see the intensification of this fanatic right policies in Israel. Massive support for ethnic cleansing, high school kids, university kids. It's not just the older generation. In fact, the younger generation is far worse than the older generation. Is this a cause for hopelessness? That can be the easy way out, the escape. Yes, let's give up hope. Israel is becoming fascist, nothing to be done. And, let's give up. But actually, as we've seen in other cases of such intensive oppression, grave oppression, it takes not just internal resistance and the will to resist, it takes international solidarity, as in boycotts and divestment and sanctions, to bring people to their senses. I've said this before, but I'll repeat it. If I were an Israeli parent, I have a daughter studying here, studying the violin at Jacob School of Music in Indiana. If I were an Israeli parent, I wouldn't want to think which platoon in the army my daughter is joining after high school. I mean, really, if I were a normal parent, not wacky, I would want to think where my daughter would go for college, what she wants to do in her life, her career, her options in life, and so on. Any normal family would like to think that way. Most Israelis cannot. It's a garrison mentality, live by the sword, as Sharon used to say. It's a very, very psychotic, abnormal society, like all colonial societies. And I said that before, it's not some genetic disorder in Israelis. It's the typical colonial society mentality. They circle the wagons and they act like a defensive tribe. The whole world hates us. They're not the first to do that. Afrikaners did this in South Africa. The French in Algeria did that. I mean, it's typical of settler colonies to do that. But once the pressure comes in and becomes very effective, you start seeing cracks in that wall of consensus. You start seeing dissent growing. We have the boycott from within group in Israel supporting the BDS movement. It's a predominantly Jewish Israeli group, the Coalition of Women for Peace. They're small groups, but they're very effective. And Israel knows they're effective. That's why they passed the anti-boycott law. So that gives us hope that with pressure, with internal resistance, with principled solidarity of progressive Israelis, we can turn the tide. And the tide is indeed turning.
Omar Barghouti, thank you very much.
Thank you.
You've been listening to a Lannan podcast. You can subscribe to our podcasts at podcast.lannan.org. In addition, the Lannan Audio Archives present similar programs by national and international writers, poets, and social activists at www.lannan.org. Listen to hundreds of hours of recorded programs from the likes of Seamus Haney, Joy Harjo, Eduardo Galeano, Arundhati Roy, Jim Harrison, Edwige Danticat, and Noam Chomsky. New programs are added every month to both the podcasts and the audio archives.